Today we're on the last part of this series on the culture of community, which fits with the summer theme, No Longer Strangers, in, I think, obvious ways. This particular session is the subset of No Longer Strangers that is called Stranger and Stranger. And we have talked about the 60s and community and contemporary community all week. Today we're going to talk about building communities. The two books that we've been looking at all week are my book, The Spirit of the 60s, which I don't have a copy of anymore because I left it for the Jubilee auction. But Carolyn has a copy of it and could show to you if you wanted to take a look at it. It looks like that. And the other one is Rooted in the Land, Essays on Community and Place, which I've been reading from time to time this week. Well, let's start. Let's begin, as we have all week, with a historical perspective, looking briefly at the communitarian personalism of the counterculture. Then we'll talk about some contemporary countercultures in urban and regenerative design as forms of community building. During the 60s, especially after the assassinations and elections of 1968 was that year of sort of incredible turmoil, with the assassination of Martin Luther King in April and Robert Kennedy in June, and the Democratic National Convention in August and the election in November. An unusual year in American history. Many young people parted from the path of both conventional and cultural politics. If the revolution could not be made in the voting booth or on the streets, and students in 1968 were trying to do both, that was the year in which many students got clean for Gene and campaigned for Gene McCarthy. Many students carried over and worked for the Humphrey campaign. Other students were on the streets all summer and at the Democratic Convention on the streets as well. But if the revolution could not be made in the voting booth or on the streets, if the powers that be would continue to be, then perhaps the revolution would come from the bottom up. In many cases, the optimism of the counterculture fed on pessimism in the new left. "I had done the political trip for a while," said one communist, "but I got to the point where I couldn't just advocate social change, I had to live it." And this whole theme of living the revolution, or of the here and now revolution, has been an important theme of the personalism that I've been talking about all week. Counterculturalists criticized the new left of the late 60s for its sacrifice of means for ends, and created communes to fuse the two. Like the anarchist hipsters of SDS, they expected political strategy and tactics to prefigure the society of the future. So in many ways, 60s people were trying to create small societies that would be a prefigurative glimpse of what they might expect to see in the future. They rejected a revolutionary theory that it called for people to do violence, which part of the SDS had come to by 1968 and 1969 with the Weathermen. And that suspended everyday life until after the revolution. Rejecting the revolutionary rhetoric of the new left, they began to imitate SDS's urban collectives, the SNCC freedom houses and Catholic worker houses, and 19th century utopian communities. The medium, they implied, was the message. Peaceable living was as important as the peace movement. By the mid-70s, several million Americans lived in about 7,000 communes. Most of them were urban and academic communes, with members often engaged in sustained social action. Reba Place in Evanston, Illinois, for example, practiced the Christian social gospel. The Kate Richards O'Hare Collective near Cornell University was based on socialist ideals. In Philadelphia, about a dozen communal houses formed in a quasi-Quaker social action community called New Life. Boston's Bread and Roses Collective offered a home place for women, while the 95th Street Collective in New York served gay men. In 1971, Susan Gowan, George Lakey, Bill Moyers, and Dick Taylor started the Movement for a New Society, establishing projects and living centers that encouraged a simple lifestyle that could sustain fellowship and moral support and solidarity against oppression. Others saw the cities as sores of urban industrialism and moved back to the land. This is actually what most people remember about communes, is the rural communes, although there were many, many more urban communes. Stephen Gaskin, a popular teacher in the free universities of the Bay Area, for example, led a group of several hundred heads to Tennessee, where they bought a farm. "I guess farming is about the cleanest way to make a living," Gaskin thought, unconsciously echoing the Catholic worker in Peter Morin, whom I doubt he knew anything about. "It's just you and the dirt and God." Others agreed that this country needs in great numbers to become voluntary peasants. Communes like the farm offered places for personalists to practice what they preached. As the New Left went national in its anti-war organizing in the late 60s, the counterculture went local in the peaceable self-organizing that predecessors like Peter Morin would have appreciated. While conscientious objectors turned to the civil disobedience of Thoreau for inspiration, counterculturalists embraced the transcendental utopianism of Emerson and Bronson Alcott. Between 1965 and 1970, counterculturalists established at least twice as many rural communes as had been established in all of American history within that 5 years. Despite the diversity of communal experience, and the diversity of communal experience in the late 60s was incredible. There were just about any kind of commune you could imagine, there was one. And then even within communes, there was a tremendous amount of diversity. All of the communes aimed at what Murray Bookchin called ecological forms of human association, the creation of communities that serve the basic needs of persons more elegantly than mainstream culture. They tried to ameliorate the alienations of modern life by creating supportive communities. Rejecting technologism and materialism, they embraced hand tools, voluntary simplicity, and sometimes a subsistence economy. To do this, they drew on anarchist traditions of the face-to-face community and often on the mystical and magical traditions of religion. Celebrating their progress to primitivism, which I think is an interesting idea, that moving to primitivism is progress, but I think many of them thought so. Their escape from the specializations of modern American life, many communes settled in out-of-the-way locations that separated them from modern American culture. In a way, what you have is a movement of secession in the late 60s. It really sets us back in the 19th century, said one communard in Grants Pass, Oregon. But after all, we're more interested in discovering the past than the future. Looking for a usable past, they tried to retain and recover the cultural wisdom of the past. While many in the counterculture suffered from what Kenneth Keniston called the fallacy of romantic regression, just there are all kinds of romantic notions about the good old days, and those were problematic for many people in the counterculture. Others saw that the past is not just past, but a path to possibilities, a resource for future planning. And many of the people I'm going to talk about later are actually looking at past patterns for present inspiration for their work. Against advertisers who almost always colonize the future, you know, promising that the future is going to be bigger and better and brighter and whatever if we buy this particular product, and who asserted, as Ford did in the 1960s with their car, the Futura, that the future is now, which always strikes me as an interesting kind of statement. Some countercultural activists revive patterns of the past that seem fulfilling to human beings. American Indian cultures offered one important model for these communitarian experiments. While Peter Morin had modeled his rural communes on the medieval peasantry, the communards of the 60s or 70s more often imitated the ideas, institutions, and spirituality of American Indians. Stuart Brand, a Stanford biology student who became interested in the new branch of biology called ecology, proclaimed that America needs Indians. He created a multimedia show called the America Needs Indian Sensorium, which was one of the scenes at the TRIPS Festival in San Francisco of 1966. 2 years later, he put out a guidebook called The Whole Earth Catalog to provide tools for living in the new America. Other models were Amish and Mennonite communities, which had practiced communitarian personalism for years. When Stephen Gaskin and his followers established their farm in Tennessee, they found that they had been preceded by Amish settlers from Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of stuff people accepted about us from the beginning, he said. Once they learned we weren't really scary, and we weren't really violent, and we really were truthful, they started thinking we were Technicolor Amish. I love that phrase. Like the Amish and the Mennonites, countercultural attempts at personal relationships in face-to-face communities often recalled the example of primitive Christianity. The communal spirit of cooperation seemed closer to the spirit of Scripture than either the spirit of capitalism or versions of the Protestant work ethic. The participatory democracy of many communes resembled the priesthood of all believers, as did the practice of consensus in leftist religious communities. Although not all communes were intentionally Christian, in fact, I think only a minority of them were, even some of the secular collectives seemed more radically Christian than the institutions of American middle-class life. Despite the efflorescence of communes and consciousness-raising groups, communal ideas were probably more preached than practiced. There was no community party of youth culture, David DeLeon notes, only an unorganized community of affection, a personalist politics of direct, simple, and natural styles of language, dress, hair, and life. Communes seldom lived up to people's imaginative expectations. While they were surely simple, they were also frequently filled with drudgery, drugs, disorder, dullness, and dirt. People who believed in the importance of community and place often showed it by moving to another community in a different place. The community created by communes, it turned out, wasn't for everybody, but the countercultural critique and the communal example got people thinking again about the origins and development of community. They turned to longstanding traditions of utopian design, especially to the Garden City movement. Instead of discarding the American urban and suburban landscapes, they tried to figure out why people liked those landscapes. Why did people move to suburbs? What did they like about it? Instead of going back to the land and the wilderness, they began to think about how to design with nature. Instead of trying to impose order on people and on the landscape, they tried to learn the order that people and the landscape revealed. In short, they began to suggest that architecture and planning are pedagogy, teaching us about ourselves and our conceptions of the world. David Orr, for example, suggests that college buildings are not just places to teach, but teachers themselves. Most of them teach students, he says, that architecture is for experts, not the people who inhabit the buildings, that architecture is merely technical, and that ethical, ecological, and ethical aspects of building are irrelevant, that the energy and environmental costs of buildings don't count much, that a successful building requires no mindfulness from the people who use it, and that the intellect can be nurtured in places largely devoid of imagination. When you think about college classrooms, for the most part, they're really dull places. I mean, they're just a bunch of tables and chairs in a room with walls that are mostly blank. Form follows function, but only if one assumes that the function of college education is to train narrow specialists with little feeling for the aesthetic or experiential dimensions of life. In contrast, Orr suggests that architecture offers us a possibility for answering the important questions that are often enclosed by our buildings. They can be more intentional and more instructive. If we pay as much attention to the built environment as to the natural environment, and indeed if we pay attention to both of them at the same time, we'll have a chance to consider questions like these. These are some questions that he has an essay called Architecture as Pedagogy in a book of his called Earth in Mind. And these are some questions that he has in mind. And as I'm asking these questions, I'd like to think about you to think about your homes and how you would answer these questions with your homes. And then think about Holden Village and the ways in which Holden Village might answer these questions. The first set of questions are ones that I would call general questions. What do we want our buildings to say about us? So what does our home say about us? What does Holden Village say about this community? What will they say about our ecological prospects? To what large issues and causes do they direct our attention? For the most part, as far as I can think about in most homes that I know, none at all. I mean, they don't direct our attention to anything. They become, in a way, invisible to us. What problems do they resolve? What problems do they cause? And here it seems to me that most architecture causes more problems than it resolves. What kind of human relationships do they encourage? Because buildings do encourage relationships. The second set of questions I would classify as ecology and economics. How much energy will this building consume over its lifetime? How much of what kinds of materials will be needed for its upkeep? What unpriced costs do construction materials impose on the environment? Are they toxic to manufacture, install, or later to dispose? How are these costs paid? What is the total energy embodied in materials used in the structure? Is it possible to design buildings that repay those costs by being net energy exporters? If not, are there other ways to balance ecological accounts? Can buildings and the surrounding landscape be designed to generate a positive cash flow? The next set has to do with ethics, which he thinks is an important architectural question. How are building materials extracted, processed, manufactured, and transported? What ecological and human costs do various materials impose where and on whom? What in our ethical theories justifies the use of materials that degrade ecosystems, jeopardize other species, or risk human lives or health? Where these costs are deemed unavoidable to accomplish a larger good, how can we balance ethical accounts? The next set I think would be called applied ecology. How does the building manage flows of resources like air and water, heat and cooling, materials and garbage, food and sewage? And this is an interesting thing for me. Usually when I think of buildings, I just think of them as places where things happen, and the building is pretty much inert. He wants to look at a building and say that a building is the sum of energy flows, or the sum of resource flows, and to see every building as a set of resource flows, which I think is just a fascinating way to think about it. Buildings can be designed, he says, to heat and cool themselves using solar energy and natural air flows. They can be designed to inform occupants of energy and resource use. They can be landscaped to provide shade, break winter winds, propagate rare plants, provide habitat for animals, and restore bits of vanished ecosystems. Buildings and landscapes, in other words, can extend our ecological imagination. And in fact, he's doing this. He's the chair of environmental studies at Oberlin College in Ohio. And they're designing a new environmental studies building where the infrastructure of the building will be, it will be entirely self-contained regenerative system. He expects that they will be able to generate more energy in running the building than they use by using passive solar construction and then active solar stuff for generating electricity. And this will all be designed into the building, and they will also take care of their sewage within the building, in those living machines that I was talking about on Thursday.
Well, we've already got that kind of in San Francisco, we call them lofts, L-O-F-T-S, where the artist works and stays and lives in buildings that were formerly warehouses and so forth. And walking up from the train station to Market Street back, but you can see rapidly for the last year or so where this is being done. Through tax laws and zoning and all that type of thing.
Right.
But it is so much wiser than to have these people, you know, way out 30 miles in the country to live.
Right. I mean, a lot of times when people think about how we're going to do ecological design, they think, well, everybody has to live on the land and take up a lot of space farming. And almost everybody who's really into regenerative design or ecological design says, no, cities are a good thing because you want concentrated populations. There are great things that happen with concentrated populations.
And it's a great place after dark. At the other cities, the malls, etc., the downtown sidewalks roll up deserted.
Right.
Not here, because they're only a few steps down to the street and they're right there.
Right. The urban villages that I'm going to talk about a little bit later actually think of streets, not just as conveyances for cars, which is what we normally think of streets for, but as landscapes for people. And so the street is intended to be mostly walked on, and they try to make them narrow enough that the cars have to go slow on them, on some of the residential streets, so that it really becomes a people place more than an automobile place.
We have a park in that neighborhood that used to be, 70 years ago, where the silver and gold kings were built their houses. Then, in more recent times, the minorities, the African Americans, and so forth, it all went downhill. And now the biomedical people are coming in. And in that same park, it's a community-wide area that the new young people have taken over as their town center.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And the last set of questions that Orr has for his building have to do with psychology and sociology, I think. And they would be, how would this building make it easier for people to be good at what they need to do? Given the purpose of a building, how can you make it easier for them to do it well? Or, how will this building make it easier for people to be good, period?
Would you repeat the name of this fellow
that... It's David Orr, O-R-R, and he's written... two books that I would really recommend. One is called Ecological Literacy, and it has more to do with higher education. The second, which is shorter essays that he wrote for a magazine, is called Earth in Mind. And most of the quoting that I've been doing this week is from that book. He's just a remarkably thoughtful
fellow.
He's
from Cleveland?
He's at Oberlin, which is near there. Orr and others are extending this thoughtfulness beyond the bounds of single buildings to the area of urban planning. In recent years, people like Peter Calthorpe from California and the team of Andres Duaney and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg have designed a movement by designing cities and communities called the New Urbanists or Neo-Traditionalists. These designers of what are called either urban villages or eco-villages have updated design principles from the American small town in order to recreate the networks of community that once existed there, and not just in the good old days. At Seaside, Florida, which is the largest operative one of these towns, the sign says, the new town, the old ways. And here are some of the principles that inform their work. First of all, they think that neighborhoods need to be designed in terms of human scale. That means that neighborhoods need to be a quarter mile or a half mile and no more from edge to edge. And that human scale comes really from their thinking about what people want. In 1989, when the Gallup poll asked people where they'd like to live, 34% said in a small town versus 24% for suburbs, 22% for farms, and 19% for cities. So they're trying to design a kind of small town feel on a human scale, which seems to be what people would really like optimally. I think their second principle is that towns are for conversation. They put their buildings close together, but they tend to put fences around the yards. In fact, in Seaside, Florida, you're required to have a picket fence, but you cannot have a, and it needs to be white, but it cannot be a picket fence. The wood has to be a different shape on every house. So you can't have a picket fence like the guy down the block, three houses. Every block has to have, every house has to have a different kind of picket fence. And this, well, let me go on here. This high density also means that it increases commerce for general stores. In the low density suburbs, like where I live right now, you can't have a lot of convenience stores or things like that because there's not enough population there to do it. And you're talking about a place where there's enough density that you can have stores which are gathering places for people. And they have in mind the old general store. The old general store would now be called the convenience store, I think. But they have in mind having convenience stores close enough that people would show up there from time to time to do things.
That's what a mall is in one sense.
A mall is, but a mall is always, it's hard to get to a mall walking. Even if you live close to a mall, the parking lots of malls tend to be immense. and these are meant to be parts of pedestrian environments in almost entirely.
So what's the difference between a convenience store and a department store?
The convenience store would be a neighborhood store that would be smaller. You still might have department stores that would be at urban cores or at intersections where they often link, they have in mind linking what they would call pocket suburbs with mass transit. And so at the places where these mass transit things came together, you might have larger kinds of malls or department stores, things like that. But in general, they're thinking about really small storefront commerce that tends to bring people together.
We live in a condominium area, and each building is a different color. And that's when I tell people how to find us. I say we're green.
Yeah.
And just half a mile from us is a humongous condominium area. Every building is the same. About how many do you suppose? 100, 200?
Oh, God.
And if you come home drunk, I think you'd have a hard time.
Actually, this used to happen in Levittown, New York, which was the first of the sort of absolutely standardized suburbs built in the late 40s and early 50s. All of the houses were exactly the same, except sometimes they were flipped from side to side, but they were really standardized, even down to having built-in TVs in the houses. So people did get disoriented for a while. What happened in Levittown, though, is that sort of people's individuality came through, and they did all kinds of different plantings, and they added on garages on the side or something in the back, so that Levittown now is a much more interesting place than it was designed to be.
Are so placed, too, so you can't look into your neighbor's window, or they can't look into yours. It's just the way they're situated,
right.
And we have plenty of land around us. So then I have a little garden.
Right. I mean, these are the kinds, I mean, all of this stuff comes down to essentially thoughtfulness. Think about what are the patterns that make people happy and paying attention to those in design. I think too often that we have considered houses as simply buildings for encasing things, and we consider them as inert forms. Frankly, Wright, for example, always said that what counted in architecture was not the building but the spaces. And you just use the building to shape the spaces. And in many ways, these new urbanists are doing that kind of thing.
When you talk about the malls, what about like the walking mall in Minneapolis, the failed walking mall in Seattle? Is that a kind of return to what you're talking about?
You mean
about?
The downtown walking mall?
Yeah.
No.
It's not exactly the same. No, these people would have traffic usually on the streets where their buildings are. There are not many of them that have anything to do at all with enclosed malls. Although I would guess that in a place like Minneapolis, you would begin to think about some enclosed malls because of the weather extremes that we have. I don't know that in many ways, malls are a useful thing for a climate like Minneapolis. And I think that's why Southdale, the world's first enclosed shopping center, is a Minneapolis mall.
Well, and the walking what do they call those, the overpasses, have developed commerce since more.
Oh, yeah, the skyways in Minneapolis have been really good that way. So that to have that kind of connection to downtown, what really benefited Minneapolis was the fact that the Dayton Hudson chain has a kind of public conscience, and so they built the first four suburban malls in Minneapolis, and they built them in such a way not to compete with their downtown store. So they were intending to maintain the downtown area in ways that I think other shopping center developers didn't. And unfortunately, they're not represented in the Mall of America.
Spokane has a skywalk. Like that.
Yeah. I mean, those are useful kinds of things. And downtown Minneapolis at noon is an interesting place, although you don't see much street traffic there. You have to actually be in the skywalks skyways to see.
But we don't give credit enough to the developers and the people who suddenly provided housing after World War II for the big crowd that needed housing.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, in the southwest part of San Francisco, you can see along the hillsides, the rows of houses
right.
that were provided. And of course, the counterculture wrote a song called Ticky Tacky. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Little boxes.
I mean, it would have been possible, probably, to have been more imaginative about creating housing for the masses.
Except at that time, people did not want the condos, the high rise. That was a reaction against that kind
right.
of living. And now that's coming back as being something that
yeah.
is not only acceptable, but desirable, perhaps. But it was this idea that nobody wanted to live in that close proximity. Well, if you're going to have big crowds and no close proximity,
right.
you're going to...
Right.
I think we all came from the farms, and so I lived in one of those little boxes. And
you preferred that to the high rise.
Huh?
You preferred that to a high rise.
Well, at the time I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have preferred a community like, you know, I think I would if I never lived there, but like Seaside or something. That
yeah.
would have been more fun.
But those of us who grew up in the cities were looking for the individualism of suburban housing.
In a way, what this movement is doing is trying to combine the benefits
and
of each to get you densities that give you a kind of city life or street life, but to give you space so that you can have a garden as well. You were going to say?
I was going to say it's easy to look backwards and say, isn't that awful what they did?
Right.
50 years ago, probably go through the same kind of thing again.
Probably.
Isn't that awful? Whatever the
right.
awful is.
Well, anyway, back to the sort of principles that they're building on. Seaside, there's a maximum 16-foot setback for houses, so your house has to be within 16 feet of the street. And that's so that people on porches can speak to people on the street. The porches have to be at least 8 feet deep so that people can actually use them, versus the situation like where I live, where the porches are just kind of quotations of porches. Ours is about 2 feet by 6 feet. If you put a chair on there, there's no room for your legs.
Especially if you're tall.
Well, I think even short people would have a hard time sitting on our porch. And our house is probably about 40 feet off the street, and we have a deck on the back, which is essentially a porch with no public function, because it just sits there in the back and you can't be seen from the street.
The whole phenomenon now, putting porches on the front. All the new houses have porches on the front. It's just
right.
real interesting.
Actually, I told the people in Chalet 1 that I was going to talk about them today. They have a great front porch culture on Chalet 1 over here. There's almost always somebody sitting on that porch, and people wander by, and they come up and they talk for a little while, and they come out.
Well, I think all the porches here are
but that one is right close to the deck, too. Yeah.
I know the chalets more than I know the
lodges.
Well,
there's
and,
a lot of them that are in the
yeah.
least Lodge 1 where I am. And
good.
There's a lot of interaction with the people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, you can think of Holden as having many of the features of these new urban villages, except here we have no cars and other kinds of restrictions that make us more sociable. We don't have TVs. I could imagine what Holden would be like if there was a TV in every room.
Well, I've heard that in the winter community, there some of them are a little unhappy that they have videos pretty often, and that kind of isolates people.
Yeah.
The most outstanding example of urban architecture occurring in the world today is in Beirut, Lebanon. And I had the privilege of attending a whole description of what's happening there. And as a part of it, the new people, the developers, want to keep the ambiance of, they arbitrarily decided, okay, we'll take Beirut the way it looked in about 1910. When the French were in there as a French colony. And so we will design our buildings along that line, and we will follow the example of Antwerp and a couple of other European cities, which are still in the old ways. Mm-hmm. And they are trying to be very careful and not to bring the new Beirut into a row of shiny high-rises.
That's neat. That's good. A third principle for these new villages is I think implicit in the others, and that's walkability. It seems to be the case that somehow physiologically feet are connected to sociability. This is a very strange thing, but feet seem to be connected to sociability because pedestrian environments often bring out friendliness. And this first occurred to me in a major way when I was at Disney World, which is in many ways the antithesis of a lot of what I'm talking about. But it is absolutely a pedestrian environment. It is, as many people have said, a place where you drive your car in order to walk. You drive to Disney World, you park your car at the hotel, and from that time on, pretty much you walk or you use public transportation that's provided by the Disney Corporation. And there is a kind of pleasure in walking, and I think some of the cleanliness and that sort of thing at Disney World comes from the fact that it's a pedestrian environment. This walkability is because people talk when they walk. The conversation that you tend to have when two people are in cars, this could be pretty much summed up like this. You know, the sort of quick wave as you go by on the street in, near your home when your neighbor is pulling out, something like that. A walkable area helps people feel safe. They feel like they know each other. We have a phrase called a nodding acquaintance, you know, that you nod at somebody as they go by. And in fact, you're at Holden, you within a week, you become nodding acquaintances with people, and that sort of interaction happens. And the safety of a place like Holden is just remarkable. All of us who are parents allow our kids to do things here that we would never let them do at home, because this seems like a safe environment. Many of them, to make places more walkable, are narrowing streets to slow cars and bring houses together. Some of them have like 22 foot street widths versus 35 or 40 feet in a normal suburb. I think the urban villages in Davis, California are down to 12 feet, where only one car can get through at a time. Fire departments get irritated at that sometimes, and so often they have to make them wider than that. They put short blocks in these places to make walking feel easier and to increase the number of corner houses, which are usually more interesting than other houses. Because people dislike large parking lots that are a part of the urban and suburban landscape, parking is provided on the street as a buffer to traffic, or parking is done in cul-de-sacs so that they can keep the streets at 12-foot widths, or garages are off of alleys to keep the house for the car, a garage, from dominating the house for the people. The suburb where I live now, there's a lot of construction of what are called executive homes, and they might have from like 3 to 5 garages, and they'd be all lined across the front because that's where the driveways are. And it's sort of, I was reading something the other day that said that many American suburbs look like they were designed for cars, you know, as if the people were cars. It has that sort of design look to them. And you can imagine somebody coming from another planet saying, you know, the really important thing in this planet, in this country, is cars. And then there are these little things that inhabit them and go back and forth and make them go, or something like that.
Is it intentional that the garages are in front, or is that just a convenience? Is it an intentionality for people to hide from their neighbors so that they're...
Well, I think it's several different things. Partly it's a hiding thing, although I think that's probably not... I think convenience is probably the main thing. It's just convenient to be able to drive up the driveway into your garage, and most suburbs don't have alleys where you could come around the back. So mainly it's a convenience. Unfortunately, in our area, architects are not paying very much attention to what it does to the symmetry of a building. They really look awful.
Yeah, but who wants to shovel a long driveway?
Not me. Not in Minnesota, I can tell you that.
And that's, you know, most homes, unless they're truly huge estates, don't have the room for the car to come around and go in the back to park. You're as close to the street as you can get, so yeah. Because they're
I mean, another example of what you can do, though, is you can actually move the houses out by the curb, put the garages out there, and then orient the houses to the center of the block where you would have a commons area. So there are ways of maintaining your convenience without having to...
This new architecture, is in new developments, or is it occurring in...
It's almost...
In the rehabilitation of old...
Most of what I'm talking about is in new developments, although there would be ways to just rezone some suburban developments so that you could get a more diverse kind of living spaces. Where I live now, the whole thing is zoned single-family homes, and that means that you largely get people of about my age with the number of kids that we have. The houses tend to be bigger than most older people want to maintain, so that they tend to move out of the neighborhood. The younger people can't afford them. So it tends to be awfully homogenous. But if you rezoned so that I could have an apartment for my mother, for example, which is now illegal where I live, then you would get a more diverse kind of population there. Or most of these people are very careful about having different sizes of architecture in these new villages so that they get some mix of population in them. But for the most part, these are new developments. But the principles that they're advancing, I think, are applicable in a lot of places. Although, you know, again, where I live, structurally, we already have 35-foot streets. I don't imagine that the city is anytime soon going to dig them up and narrow them down. And if they narrowed them down, we wouldn't be any closer to the house across the street because those are already built.
The city where my office is, the school district, and the whole block is a huge complex high school. Across the street is a middle school and some apartments, and the city is in the process right now of closing that street down and narrowing it.
Oh.
Traffic is too fast there, and I thought these people are crazy. Now that I'm listening to you, I guess they're not as crazy as I thought they were. But they are narrowing the street to slow the traffic down because of the safety, primarily of the middle school kids. The high school kids are able to maintain.
Right. I mean, part of what these people are thinking about is that often now neighborhoods are defined by the perimeter of fast streets. You know, every 8 blocks in a major city, there's a street that's pretty much a through street, and the traffic moves pretty fast and it's pretty thick, and you don't want young kids crossing it. So essentially, you've defined your neighborhood by where you put your streets. And they will still have some of those streets in their developments, but often they tend to do things like have T intersections with streets so that traffic comes up and then you've got to turn right or left, and that tends to slow things down, and it also tends to provide places. The T intersection makes a nice place for a public building like a church or a school or something like that, because it means that your traffic is coming at it and you can do a really nice architectural facade in front of that.
In Sacramento, they're doing just that to the old part of town. Blocking off streets and changing from one way back to two way, because the one way streets became commuter streets.
Right.
And so, in order to get the community back, they're blocking all kinds of streets and enforcing the traffic onto one street instead of many and going back to two way streets.
I mean, one interesting strategy that cities can take, I mean, essentially there is to say that we prefer cars over people. Another strategy that they could take is simply not to extend or expand streets, which would move people eventually, I think, into mass transit more than they are now. Politically, this is really dicey, and I would say right now impossible. People just won't put up with sitting on freeways for a long period of time without protesting, and they're trying to expand the freeways. And actually, the worst part of freeway in the Twin Cities area is one that I have to drive every day. And so I'm ambivalent about this question. Because I don't go to a place that I could take mass transit to either, which many people don't now because of the patterns of settlement and work.
Okay, but let's talk about the political part of it and the place where Christians and so forth are asleep at the switch. In our hometown, the city council has opened up sidewalk eating, and so it's new for us. And they also have... at one time said if you opened a restaurant, you had to have X number of parking spaces in the back. They canceled that, and they reduced that. So now, We have a whole street full of Starbucks and coffee houses and all of that, which has changed totally the scenery and the ambience of our town, and people kind of come and mellow out and sit around. Of course, part of that, as we know, is that in California, smokers have to stay outside. So you have a constituency to sit outside to begin with, but that's attracted the others. But what I'm getting to, if that was a conscious decision by the city council, and therefore any of us that want to make changes should become quite acquainted with our city, the city council, how they make their decisions, and that would make the difference.
It would. You're right. I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about maybe the first day, which is sort of how do we change things. A lot of it simply has to do with activity. A lot of it has to do with activity at the local level, because they are making changes at that level.
Last hour we referred to that because we mentioned another community that's across the freeway from us. A totally planned community with a lot of the things that you are describing in terms of the way homes are built and the way buildings are there to encourage community, but not one space for one church. Where were the Christians when the plans were going through the council? Yeah. You know, that's the kind of thing that we get all upset about the streets.
Right.
But nobody thought about the church. It's a lovely community, and it has some high-rise buildings, yeah. Some low, all in cul-de-sacs, and great community. Also has no school. It's now coming back in connection with the library.
Huh.
But also, Marion, those churches in this, it's called Foster City.
No, not Foster City. I'm talking about
Redwood Church. 10,000 people.
It's not a separate city, but it is because it's physically disjointed.
Uh-huh.
I think also, you know, if we're going to look at this from a Christian point of view, we need to look at, especially when we're reclaiming urban things, that, as you said, that the minorities have taken over and now the young people are taking over and it's a different community again. Well, what happens to these poor? Are they just displaced and gone? I know in Chicago, a Christian group has built a high-rise called the Atrium, which has a balance of not only of ages and family sizes, but also economics. Yeah. So that planned right into that building is a variety of economic levels.
Well, this is what urban redevelopment does.
Yeah.
It does move frequently the poor out.
And well, sometimes doesn't have any plans for wealth where they will go.
Yeah.
They just say, you're out of here. We've condemned your building, and they take it over for upper middle class. And whole communities are built for upper middle class or middle class people. And sometimes in doing that, we displace people.
Yes, but do you
and
also
make
want
no
those,
plans
yeah.
for them?
Yeah. But if they stay
but,
where they are,
well,
we
and I think
want
if
them
we're
to be there either.
Yeah, and if we're looking at Christian values, I think we do need to think. Because if you have the mix, then there isn't the fear that there is if they're living in separate communities.
I mean, essentially, this is a place where you often need politics to reconfigure the market, because the effective demand of poor people is not enough to get developers to be developing
and
architecture
and
for them.
And for themselves.
And in order to create the effective demand, you have to put often public dollars for the kinds of projects that you're talking about.
That would include
about.
some of those communities.
That's happened in our church. We have a group called St. Andrew's Housing Group, and the public dollars are there, and the state is screaming for people to spend it. But they need organizations who are competent that can take the money, make the plan, the development, get the contractor, and spend that money. And that's what a subgroup of our congregation is doing, in building apartment houses around the east side for low cost.
That you have something where single parents could afford to live.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it, 20-25%? If our population is poor, so if you're planning a facility like that, you might want to look at maybe having 20% of the housing there be for low-income families or single parents. That would be subsidized housing.
Well, this is all subsidized.
Yeah, well, see, then you segregate people again.
Well, but they're small units within the
within
existing
a larger
community.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which has very little low-cost housing.
Right. In the Twin Cities now, the Metro Council, which doesn't have any sort of clout, is trying to get cities or trying to get the suburbs to voluntarily set percentages of low-cost housing that will be available in their suburbs. Really hard to do.
Miniature,
and a lot of it has to do just with land costs, because the land costs in developing suburbs are so high that to build any kind of house on a space and make it affordable is really difficult. But again, you need the politics then to reconfigure the market.
Let's take another game. So these people, well, we know who we're talking about, the low-income people, were there. We're talking about percentages and laws and so forth. By what formula, by what right, that it so happens near where we live is, on the one side, a community called Atherton, tons of money, millions. On the other side up the hill, further away, a town called Hillsborough. Now, I would like to live in either one of those two. Now, but we can't afford it, of course. So would I go marching into the town fathers and say, to be Christian, will you need to have 10%, 20% for low-income people like me? And they say, well, our property values are going to go down if you move in. So I say, well, that's what I say in our hometown when the people want to come in and next door with different values, different lifestyles, different whatever. And so to what extent are we obligated to accommodate people who just arbitrarily decide, I'd like to live there?
Great question. Hard question.
Well, the interesting thing, this community that we described that had no churches planned, that community also has low cost, not affordable, but the next step down, low cost housing in the mix of the housing, and you can't tell the difference. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But boy, was there screaming before it went up.
Oh.
Right. I suspect there's almost always going to be more screaming before than after.
But as you go through the community now, you can't, if you don't know, you can't decide which is the low cost and which is the ordinary housing.
Right. One other strategy for dealing with the question of property values, and in a way what you have is a situation where people's attachment to private property makes it difficult for to make the decisions that they might want to make as Christians. And one way of dealing with that in some places is to create what's called a community land trust, where a group of people might buy a lot of land or develop the land together, and then instead of selling the land to the people who live in the houses, they sell the houses to the people who live in the houses. And there are then stipulations about the land trust, which then is a democratic participatory organization of the people who live there and the people who actually own the community that owns the land, is able then to make those kinds of decisions without having the same kinds of effects on property values as you would otherwise. This has been something that's been found, actually done more in New England and more for rural lands than for urban or suburban lands. But it is an effective way of making a kind of participatory democracy in the economic sphere by having the community actually own the land and then lease it or sell only the particular property on the land, but not the land itself. So you might have a farmer who buys the farmstead and can sell that for whatever profit he can on the improvements that he's made on the farmstead, but he can't sell it to, say, a developer who's going to make a suburb out of it, because the land trust owns the land. So that there are ways of, again, negotiating the private-public boundaries in ways that would make it more possible to do some of these things. Well, this is great. I'm not actually having to do any of this lecture because everything is coming up here. I can come back to some of this stuff about urban villages in a little bit if you want to, but I want to talk a little bit about something that I think is even more radical than that, and which I hinted at the other day when I was talking about living machines, and that's to talk about this man here. Actually, the man who wrote this book. This is not a man. The man who wrote this book, John Tillman Lyle, Regenerative Design for Sustainable Development. And most of these urban villages are still basically unsustainable in the long run. They're not. They're dependent on cars. They're dependent on fossil fuel sources and things like that. And Lyle is beginning to think about regenerative design, anticipating that we are coming to the end of the age of extravagance, and that as part of the community of nature, we need to use nature without using it up. Lyle is working to design spaces and places that regenerate natural systems as they function. And you could hear some of the impetus for that also in the questions that David Orr was asking. Can you actually generate surpluses of energy in a building that you're building? And Lyle says often, yes. And this is a very long and complex book, and I have a hard time summarizing all of the principles of regenerative design. But I want to give a couple of examples. One of the buildings that he features in this book is the Rocky Mountain Institute, which I mentioned to Martin Wells here at Holden the other day, because it's in the Rocky Mountains. It's a cold climate. They get a lot of snow. And so the challenge was, can we make a building that has a net energy surplus in a place where it gets really cold? And the answer was yes. The Rocky Mountain Institute is the home of Hunter and Amory Lovins, who are really energy specialists and particularly interested in renewable kinds of energy. And it's also the home of the Rocky Mountain Institute. So it's a 4,300 square foot structure that houses their offices as well as their private residence. Even in the extreme cold of Rocky Mountain winters, the Institute building stays warm with no use of fossil fuels for heating. It accomplishes this primarily through the use of very thick insulation, massive materials for thermal storage, a glass roof sun space to emit solar radiation, and a large array of small energy efficient devices. So essentially what they're doing is saying the energy input in the Rocky Mountains is sunlight. So we have to figure out how to take the sunlight that shines on this building throughout the year, and they can calculate that, and they can calculate the angle that the sunlight's going to come at, and all that sort of thing, and then adjust the building to the sunlight, basically, is what they're doing. Hang on just a second. So what they do is they have 16-inch thick walls of stone that's native there. And these are a thermal mass. I learned about thermal masses when I was doing a thing on I do this 19th Century Farmer Act in Minnesota, and he lived in a log cabin, and I started thinking about log cabins. And you think that, you know, a log cabin would be pretty cold because there's no barrier there. It's just logs, and the stuff can come through. But essentially, in a log cabin, the logs operate as a thermal mass. You get a good fire going in the fireplace, and the logs all heat up, and they hold the heat. The heat, there's always transference, but they hold enough of the heat that a log cabin can be warm. And it actually is the case that in the late 19th century, given heating techniques, when people switched to balloon frame housing, which is pretty much this kind that we do now with 2x4s, their houses were colder than they were in log cabins. So you have this great thermal mass in the Rocky Mountain Institute, and in the middle of it, I'll pass this around, you can take a look at a picture of it, has this great slanted greenhouse area where they actually grow fruit. It is a greenhouse. They grow plants and animals in that area. But both at the bottom of that and the back of that are these thermal masses that are picking up heat that is then transferred to the rest of the building in a variety of ways. They have a fish pond there that grows fish. They have fruit trees and other plants inside the house. They have structured their windows so that they have more insulation value than most windows. They have a small clothes drying room so that they don't have to have a clothes dryer. They're essentially solar clothes drying from the heat of the sun. They have 5 air-to-air heat exchangers that ventilate the house. They use compact fluorescent bulbs, on-demand water heaters, and they generate their own electricity with photovoltaic cells on the roof that they have to adjust every season so that they get them at the right angle to pick up the most of the sun's rays. They generate an average of about 9 kilowatt hours per day in the summer and 6 in the winter. That's more than double the power that they use in the building, although it's considerably less than the amount used in the average American home. So part of what you have to figure is that people need to be thinking in ways that are less energy intensive and using appliances that are less energy intensive. Another thing that this guy did was he's building at Cal State Pomona, the Center for Regenerative Studies. And so they're building buildings to exemplify the principles that they're trying to teach at the Institute. And so they did an accounting of students in dorm rooms to see what kind of energy they use. and discovered that the two biggest uses of energy in dorm rooms are refrigerators and then a clothes dryer that students use for drying their clothes and that sort of thing.
Not the microwave.
Actually, microwaves are not bad because they're very short, intense bursts of energy. Popcorn poppers was another thing that the students used, but popcorn poppers only, I'm really glad to hear this because I'm a popcorn addict. Popcorn poppers operate for such a short time that they're not a significant energy drain. It tends to be refrigerators and clothes dryers are the two energy drains. So at a place like this, I don't know what they do for refrigeration at the Rocky Mountain Institute, but they have solar clothes drying, essentially, and in Cal State Pomona, they'll be able to do the solar clothes drying as well. They're going to take the refrigerators out of the rooms, I think. As long as it's an enclosed space, the sun's heat will come into a room and probably dry clothes. Because essentially they let the short waves come in, and then once they reflect off something, they're long waves and they don't go out. So you can get the sun's heat in there. Anyway, given their situation in the Rocky Mountains, they are over 130% solar, which is to say they generate 30% more energy than they need. And they sell that then to an electric utility so that there actually are a surplus energy.
Who's the author of that book?
John Lyle, L-Y-L-E, and he's the head of the Center for Regenerative Studies. You had a question a while back.
Well, as the news item, you talk about solar heating. We've been told that in the winter here at Holden Village, sunlight lasts only 1 hour each day.
That would be tricky.
It's daylight, but it's only 1 hour of actual
of direct sun. Yeah, that would be a problem here. and then you might put your photovoltaic somewhere else than in the village and try to distribute them to the village or something like that. Almost everything that they do in regenerative design tries to build redundancy into systems so that you're not absolutely dependent on anything, on any one source of energy. And so they would probably, they wouldn't say, okay, we're going to change Holden Village to all solar. What they would still do is hydroelectric, which they already do here and is the main source of energy.
That's made quite a difference in the village when they did not have the major hydroelectric power system that we now have, and it was dependent on generators.
Yeah. And it's quite a difference in the village between summertime when they have a lot of flow and not so much flow in the wintertime. Somebody was telling me it was here over the winter that they were doing some construction here, and every time they started the bandsaw, all the lights went out because they have just a very little bit of energy here in the wintertime. So this is one example of something that they're doing in regenerative design. Another example that he has in here is the project in Davis, California, which is one of the first urban village projects called Village Homes. And it's not entirely regenerative, but it has a lot of the principles that we've talked about so far in terms of walkability and conversation and that sort of thing. But they've also been attentive to the way that they orient houses north to south to try to get the optimum amount of sunlight into the houses, the way that they put overhangs so that you get the optimum amount of sunlight in the summer when the sun is low. No, the other way around. The optimum amount of sunlight in the winter when the sun is low and the overhangs cut off the hot summer sun.
Didn't the Romans try to do that?
Yeah, I mean, many of these things are not new. In the house that I grew up in, we had these devices that I tell students were called awnings. What's that? Awning? How do you pronounce that? How do you spell that? But this is essentially what an awning was for. Awning was a device that people could use if they were mindful about where they were and how hot it was in the house to adjust the amount of sunlight that was coming into the house. And this is one of the things that almost all of these regenerative design people want, is to have situations where people have to pay attention to the house. And this will be very different for us because most of the time in our houses, you just get up in the morning, you adjust the thermostat to what you want, and then you never have to pay attention to it anymore. But they think that it's an important educational thing for people to have to be attentive to their houses and make the adjustments to nature that would optimize the efficiency of the houses.
It has great implications for teaching and learning because children need to learn very early a lot about physics.
Right.
Transfer of energy and all of that, but they now,
It's like, you know, we joke about kids think that eggs come from cartons.
Right.
And, you know, we have a tendency to think that heat comes from that little thing on the wall.
Right. And this is what Lyle would say is that he uses the term paleotechnic and neotechnic society. He says that we now live in a paleotechnic society, and we're eventually going to have to move to a neotechnic society. And in a paleotechnic society, essentially what you do is you try to take, in an industrial society, industry looks to us so dirty and it generates pollutants and things like that, that we've just segregated that from us. So, the, you know, the utility plant that generates electricity for my house, in Minnesota, 43% of my energy is nuclear. So every time I turn on a light switch, I'm supporting the nuclear power industry. And the rest of it is probably coal generated. And that has its own problems, and I probably wouldn't want my house right next to a coal generating plant. So the paleotechnic era has really segregated the sort of infrastructure of the society from where we live. And the neotechnic era, they say, will be integrating the sort of production of energy and the flows of resources, because nature tends to work in localities, on site. So the paleotechnic era believes out of sight, out of mind, and that's a good thing. The neotechnic era believes in a way on site, S-I-T-E, in sight, S-I-G-H-T, and in mind, as a kind of strategy for living. Those are about the main things that I wanted to say today. Although I could circle back to a few of the things that were in the...
I just want to comment about the townhouse that I live in. We bought a small townhouse complex in Clement, Minnesota. And the streets are very narrow between the two houses, and everybody has a one-level place. And I grew up, or I was in a suburb where the houses were much further apart. Now, you know, whenever you get in your car, there's somebody out getting in their car and you talk and,
yeah.
You know, and I didn't even think about that until you brought it up. People go out for walks and we've got our kitchen right there and you holler hi.
Right.
You stop in and have a cup of coffee. It's much more intimate.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, there's a whole movement now of what are called intentional communities. And what these authors would say is that in many ways all communities are intentional. There's an oxymoron. They do create the things, but that you can't be intentional about the way that you design so that you get effects that you want.
But I did have a little trouble with it in a way because I felt kind of almost violated in a way. I mean, it
right.
took me a while to get used to that closeness.
Right, and you know, obviously, if you travel around the world, you see that the people in the world have different kind of senses of space than we do. I know I was in Italy for a year when I was a sophomore in college and spent my whole year backing up because, you know,
they were right there on top of you.
They wanted to be right there talking to me, and then, boy, that was inside my bubble. So I would just keep backing up all the time. I could have gone off the edge of the earth. But obviously, people can adapt to smaller spaces if they choose to, and in many cases, if people knew what the advantages of smaller spaces were, they might do that. You, in a way, accidentally moved into a place like that, but others of us might think that might be kind of nice, and if I could find a place like that, I would be interested in living there. And then the market might begin to move in the direction of eco villages or regenerative design.
Excuse me, the people in our condo. If they have dogs, they have a great time talking with each other on our street. We have a secluded street, so to speak.
Right. I mean, in many ways, dogs are an excuse for conversation anyway, I think.
Have a community, get a dog.
Yep.
Require everyone to have a dog.
Yeah.
It has to be walked.
Oh, man, I'd have to move out of Minnesota then. Our kids have wanted a dog for years and years and years, and knowing kids, they always say, oh, yeah, we'll take care of it.
Right,
but knowing kids, I know I would be walking it in January, and this is the main reason that we've not had a dog.
My dog raised my children very well, and now that the children are gone, so was his dog. The thing that is just me too came to mind that we haven't discussed is this closeness and the urbanization, et cetera, and the cultures of our country. 3 years ago, I moved to the Pacific Northwest from the Midwest, where good fences make good neighbors. And boy, that's not part of that culture at all, in at least part of the Pacific Northwest that I'm in. And yet in the Midwest, you are comfortable entering each other's homes. Coffeeing, as you were talking, is part of the culture. When I organized a neighborhood watch group and invited people into my home for coffee for the first meeting, they all stood at the door like they were entering some foreign land.
Hmm.
We don't enter each other's homes, we meet in driveways.
That's interesting.
And once it starts to rain in the wintertime, see you in the spring.
I mean, it is the case in our neighborhood that when it starts to snow in the wintertime, you don't really see people except when they're out with their snowblower, and that's not a good talking time when it's going.
But I must add, it's also a rural area that I live in.
Cultures are created, they exist where they already are. I mean, as I tell my students, you're ruled by dead people. Some dead people thought that was a good arrangement to meet mainly on driveways, and so that culture has been created in that area. Those are all changeable things. The variables by which community are created are changeable. But it takes a kind of intentionality to do that.
What you're talking about, I think, is going to have significant change on some culture.
Oh yeah, it's going to have a major impact on American culture. I do think that for the last 150 years we've been in a kind of culture that's not sustainable, and that we have created cultural patterns that are dependent on fossil fuels and transportation of things, and that is not going to be possible long into the future. And we will have major cultural changes coming. But we've had five or six major cultural changes already. In American history, and American history is not all that long, so it's not that we can't have major cultural changes, it's that this one, in a way, we can anticipate and plan for and think about how would we like to live in the future.
But because we have encouraged individualism for so long in our country, it's going to be difficult for great numbers of people to warm to this intimacy.
Yeah.
And part of how I see that in the church is the number of people who don't want to sit in the front row. And because the roommate does not like to sit in the front row, and I do, we do not sit together. And so we've tried to analyze, why is it that she feels as she does? And I don't know that she is certain, but I like being in the front row because then my view is unobstructed. Also, there's more space.
There's more leg room for tall people. This is something I know.
Mm-hmm. A school architect for high schools that, we're adding new wings, doing everything he builds has a little mini amphitheater.
Yeah.
So that kids can sit around and talk and not go out to the parking lot to gather. They have little mini gathering spots. That you can tell when he's the architect at a school because they're at these little gathering spots.
Inside or outside?
They're outside. In California, they're outside. Okay.
The Center for Regenerative Studies has the same thing. That they create conversation spaces, and we're actually in the process of designing a new student center at St. Olaf, and I've got on the committee simply because I'm interested in these kinds of things. Can we create different kinds of conversational spaces at the...
And I don't know whether kids are using them or not because I've not taken the time to go to that particular spot when I'm at the school.
Yeah, right.
But it'll be interesting to know whether kids really want to use the gathering spot that's been built for them.
Right. Well, my guess is that they will use about half of them, and the other half they will design spaces of their own out of, we'll give them a building and they will redesign the building to configure to their needs, and that's fine. And we have tried to make the building flexible enough that we can adapt then the building to the culture of the students, although we've had a tremendous amount of student input in putting together this building. It's really been fun to do because the architects are really thoughtful. Mm-hmm. We tell them these are the kinds of interactions that we want to have, and they come back and say these are the kinds of spaces that we think would give you those interactions, and here are the kinds of materials that we think would work, and we look at them and say, I don't think you heard us right on that, because that is just simply not going to work here. You've got to try something else. For example, we have a lot of wood at St. Olaf, one of their early designs didn't have very much wood in the design at all. We just said that won't work. It's not a part of our culture to have it that way.
We didn't ask for the gathering spaces. It was the architect that told us that's what we needed, which was interesting.
That's really
we asked for the classrooms and we built the gathering spaces.
Yeah. See, I think that's...
And the students didn't ask for them either, did they?
Well, probably not in that sense, and I think the first, his first go-around didn't include a lot of students. Now we're doing some massive reconfiguring, and there are students on committees.
I mean, more and more, you're getting a kind of community architectural design. At Oberlin, where David Orr is doing that new building, they had people from all constituencies involved in that. In fact, at St. Olaf, we had committees, on the, some of the early committees, we had people from Northfield who are not affiliated with the college to think about, are there ways in which we can build spaces that would be amenable to them? We had alumni who are not a lot around the college a lot, but might only come back once a year or something like that, to think what in a student center would make it a welcoming place for them. So I think, you know, the more intentional that you are about these things, the better off you can be. Boy, what good timing. Thanks all for coming.